Hello and welcome to the Reloading Rag Chew. I hope you guys are having a good day. I'm here in the North Georgia Mountains in the middle of the Cahutta Wilderness, taking a nice little camping trip. One thing I think I'm going to change up a little bit is things have gotten complicated. I'm trying to spend less time on the computer, less time on social media. I found that I was doing a bit too much of that with my job and, you know, it was really kind of burning me out. So trying to get out and go camping more, get out in the great outdoors. I'm sure a lot of you guys can appreciate that, given most shooters are also fairly avid outdoorsmen, especially those of us that reload and those of you that reload for hunting even more so. So I'm going to try and start recording these in more of a batch type of format. So go on a trip, spend the afternoon, record for 2 or 3 hours, get me a bunch of them, and then let them slowly work out as, you know, the coming weeks and months go, and then rinse and repeat. So not going to do as much of the news segment kind of stuff, things like that, because what I record now may very well not be relevant. I will say that when something big comes around, like if any new news comes out at SHOT Show about new presses or equipment, I'll do special episodes for that and try and make this fairly timely. Not that there's usually a ton of reloading stuff that comes out at SHOT Show. What I wanted to talk about, and I don't know how many of you guys have seen it or read it or seen it out there, there's an article written in Precision Shooting Magazine, which is since defunct. I think they closed up somewhere in the early 2010s, probably a victim of, like so many other print magazines, just are giving way to people who can get instant content and look up what they want on Google or Facebook without having to wait. But aside from that part, magazines did have some really interesting information and stuff that they invested time and money in that you don't see happen on a forum or a Facebook group or anything like that. And one of the things that they had, and this was back years ago, I think it came out in the early 90s, was an article called The Secrets of the Houston Warehouse. Now, the good thing is the magazine is shut down. However, either as a result of that or just as a result of them being good-hearted and not holding their copyright and wanting to charge for back issues, this is readily available on the internet now. So go out there, search for Secrets of the Houston Warehouse. The original article was by Dave Scott. You should be able to find it. I will put a link up on Facebook, I think, probably, if I can find a good, clean copy of it. But it's a really interesting article. And basically what it outlines is there was a gentleman in Houston, Texas, back in the 70s, that owned a large warehouse. It was around 300 something yards long, fully enclosed, made out of concrete. So when you think about it, it was perfect for shooting. It was temperature stable. There was never any wind. There was never rain. None of the problems that we normally blame our inaccuracies on. You lost all of those. And what it turned into was the guy that owned it was a bit of a shooter himself, and he had a friend that was, and, you know, over time he kind of built a network by having this. It wasn't open to the public. This wasn't a shooting range that you could go to and just sign in and pay a fee. You had to be invited there. So very few shooters ever went there, and they were always, they were basically the top of their class for that time period of competitive shooters. A lot of the names that you'll notice in the article are now names that are associated with various precision gunsmith companies. So, but it's a very, very interesting article because while they didn't use super scientific, it wasn't like a lab-grade experiment, what they did do is that by eliminating so many of the factors, they were able to get some very, very accurate rifles. You know, they talk about how they got numerous rifles down to where that they would shoot under 0.050, so 50 thousandths of an inch accuracy. And that would be repeatable. It wouldn't be the typical bragging, you know, oh, this great three-shot group and ignore the rest that are on the paper that are horrible. So, reading the article, it puts some interesting perspective and it brings up some interesting points. One about rifle building, and I won't get into that too much on here. I'm not that experienced with rifle building. I understand from my side hobbies of machining why there is such difficulty in building a rifle well, and especially in a mass production environment. It's easy to see why a hand-produced rifle can be more accurate. But the other thing that he talks about in here, and this is an interview that happened years after the actual shooting, but is what happened with the reloading and what was discovered. And it does sound like, with the exception of, you know, you've got to have a good rifle, you got to have a good scope. It sounds like they had a lot of basic issues with people, and it was just a, you know, the scope wasn't mounted correctly. There was something wrong with the gun. So we're going to ignore all those because this isn't a gunsmithing podcast. But he started talking about the reloads, and it's really interesting some of the conclusions that he came to. And I think the biggest one that stands out to me reading the article is he makes it sound like the biggest factor he found in accurate ammunition was the neck tension. And he had a huge process that he would do of turning the necks down, then sanding the necks down, then how he seated the bullets was very consistent. In fact, he did it by hand. He didn't use a press at all. Because basically at the level that his neck tension was at, there was no need for a press. You didn't need that much force to seat the bullet in. He also talks a little bit about whether you seated in the lands, off the land, so on and so forth. An interesting thing is he said that of what he tested, everything that was successful, he seated into the lands, and I think he had a formula in there of you would seat it into half the width of the lands. Now, I think that this may partially be something that was an occurrence of the bullets of those days. I know a lot of manufacturers now test their bullets and will say they shoot best this far off the lands. So I think that might have been, you know, some of the newer high-tech bullets may ignore that. But even then, I keep getting back to this neck tension because he even says that he found no major differences in primers, yet if you talk to a lot of bench rest shooters, they'll tell you that primer choice is everything, and that if you're not shooting the Federal Gold Match primers, you're not going to get accurate groups. Well, based on what he found, that may not be true. In addition, he says that within reason, so obviously you can't be swinging a grain here and there, the powder mattered, but the exact powder charge didn't matter. And it doesn't get real scientific on the amount, but it does mention that he was using a powder thrower for his consistency, which even the best powder thrower, you're going to be somewhat limited. So it's very interesting because, you know, there's a lot of guys out there and there's a lot of advertisements for scales that can do a 1/10th of a grain, or 1/10th of a grain, 0.01. And from the sound of it, at least from his findings, that's not necessary to achieve accuracy. But what is necessary is being able to precisely turn the necks. And I think that the case consistency helps here. So you've got to start with good quality cases. This is something that would be a good experiment to do with Lapua or Peterson or brass like that. I don't think you're going to get these same kind of results if you're shooting mixed brass, or even if you're shooting, you know, a bunch of Winchester or what I'll call average grade, shooter grade brass, not precision grade. But getting those case necks to a precise measurement and precision smooth, and then seating the bullets exceedingly consistently. seating those bullets by hand so that you can feel when there's any type of issue, when there's anything wrong. And now, an interesting thing when you think about it is most of us tend to have a press with a fairly long handle on it. A lot of that is because we need that extra leverage for when we're resizing cases, especially if you're doing forming of cases. Now, that long handle, when you go to seat the bullet, you don't need that much force, but we tend to still grip the handle at the end. That will give us plenty of leverage, but you're losing a lot of the feel of seating the bullet. And I will say, every now and then when I'm seating a bullet, I can feel one that seats wrong. Something doesn't feel right. I don't usually pull them. Sometimes I pull them, and I usually do find that there's a burr on the bullet or something like that. But that's only getting to a level that's well below the level that, according to this article, you need. So how could we get a more precise bullet seating? Obviously, an arbor press gives you more feel. And that's why a lot of precision shooters will use a straight arbor press. I think that there are some out there, and this is where I'm going to show my ignorance on the super precision world. I think that there are some presses out there that use like a hydraulic type or some sort of strain gauge to determine how much pressure you're putting on it. And that in itself would help solve this issue. If not, I can see using some sort of precise hydraulics as a method to seat the bullets consistently and measure the tension. And that's one thing. I was talking with a machinist friend of mine who was into shooting, and he said, you know, a lot of precision reloaders, they talk about neck tension, but all of them measure neck tension by the thickness of the neck and, you know, sometimes the ID compared with the bullet. There's very few that measure neck tension, if any, and there's very little commercial equipment out there to measure neck tension by actually seeing how hard it is to move the bullet. And that was an interesting thing because we're basically, as a community, measuring something by using another measurement and inferring what that it translates through. So I think that is kind of a big takeaway from this article that I have, and something that I'd really like to think about. And I kind of am mulling over in my mind of, if this guy is correct, you know, we're going to assume he is. He obviously, you know, he said that at his best, he was able to get his rifles down to 0.025 of an inch groups. I don't know if I could accurately measure that because I'm not sure if I could tell the difference between that and a single hole. I think at that point, what paper you use for your target starts to matter, that it doesn't tear out too bad. So, you know, I'm very impressed with the idea of this. And I think it's worth mulling over and thinking over and trying to come up with, okay, if I know that this is true, how do I take advantage of this information? And can it be proved again? And if so, does this change ideas in the industry and the practice? Would knowing this information and being able to repeatedly prove something like this and, you know, in the end come up with a piece of equipment that can reliably do this and can be produced for, you know, more than one person, where it's not a single hand-fitted item. What does that change about the mentality? You know, if the primer does not overtly matter, then the issue that, you know, I've had it at times of finding whatever the holy grail of primers is, you know, if it's a federal match grade primer, well, for a while there, those were nearly unobtainium during the panic. And when people did find them, they were buying stores out to try and stock up on them. Well, what if there's not a big difference between a CCI primer and a federal primer. Well, that opens up and fixes a lot of potential supply and demand issues. In fact, right now, I have quite a few 308 for my, not that precision, but precision for me rifle. And I've got them loaded with the S&B primers that were on sale back at Cabela's years ago. Why? Because it's what I had on hand when I started loading this. I've got some federal non-match, regular federal large rifles to try in it. But maybe that doesn't matter. Maybe I should have stocked up on those S&B primers. By the way, unfortunate thing, I was talking to the reloading guy at my local Cabela's. After the buyout with Bass Pro, their contract and agreement with S&B did not get moved over, and he said that those primers will be going away. So not only are we probably not going to see them at that price, that great $16 a box price, but we're probably going to see them start disappearing from the shelves. I'm sure all of you will be sad knowing that, and I think most of us wish that when those were that price, we had stocked up and basically bought as many as we could fit in our house. But back to the main story. So maybe the primer brand doesn't matter as much, which that makes it easier to get into the precision rifle. It does sound like neck turning is an important part of it. And this is something that I really want to take a look at as a machinist mentality. Because a lot of the neck turning tools that I see out there are very crude. They kind of remind me, I used to do RC car racing. And this was back years ago, before brushless motors were a big thing. And one of the big things that everyone always told me for motor performance was turning your commutators. Basically, you'd wear grooves in them from where the brushes touched them. You also had to refurbish your brushes. And if you turn those back to fresh copper and got them all even, your motors would perform more predictably. And I did find this to be true, but the interesting thing that I found was I finally bought at what, for the time, because I was a teenager at the time, was a fairly enormous expense. It was probably $100, a commutator lathe. And what I quickly discovered was what this thing was that, you know, people had said was great and was this special purpose piece of equipment was nothing more than really a pair of V-blocks and the crappiest carbide cutter I'd ever seen. You know, it was nicely machined. It was nicely finished. You know, it was designed where you could throw it in your pit box and take it with you. So I'll give it credit on that. But what had never occurred to me was I could have just chucked these motors up in even a wood lathe and gotten equivalent results. So before I run out and buy one of these various neck turning tools that are out there, I have a little Sherline, not a Sherline, sorry, a little Unimat lathe, vintage little piece. I've also got a much bigger lathe, medium sized according to most real machinists, but I've got a bigger lathe. I have access to a medium Chinese import, you know, Chineseium lathe. I want to experiment with this, and I think the Unimat is going to provide as much precision as I would get out of any of the commercial neck-turning lathes, without getting into maybe like the level of Sinclair. So I'm going to start experimenting with this. And what I really want to try and do is see, for one, how much neck tension affects this. I want to get a set of cases where the neck tension is absolutely as identical as I can. I think I'm probably going to have to buy some new measuring instruments. Most of mine go to 1/1. For the precision that I think I need, I'm going to probably get a tenths indicator, so that's 1/10 of 1,000. It's probably going to take some special, I'm probably going to need to make some high-speed steel cut tooling, because I really don't see carbide doing that great a job on brass. Plus, carbide is a little less predictable, and you can't take as fine of a cut. But I think it's worth it. And then the other thing that I really have to wonder out of here is if neck tension is so critical, could it be that even using mixed brass, if you get the neck tension consistent, that you can get consistent groups out of brass? So, you know, that's kind of a real question that I have is, in the, you know, in this article, he discusses what the brand of brass that he was using was. And it was something that I'm fairly certain is no longer around anymore. But can you get equivalent results with good brass prep? So can you take 100 pieces of, let's say, Lapua brass out of the box, load them without doing anything, versus can you take 100 pieces of mixed brass, and let's say, probably for argument's sake and a bit of safety for the gun, that one side of the brass, you know, like let's take 308. So this would vary. If you're shooting 6.5 Creedmoor, you're not going to have this problem. But let's say 308, because that's what I'm probably going to be loading for. So if I took my brass and I divided it into half commercial and half military head stamp, that way we get the case dimension out of the way. And I took that military brass and I prepped it and got the neck tension as exact as I could, even among different years, whether it was Lake City or other plants, whatever it might be, would it have the same accuracy with that as it would taking a commercial high-end brass like a Lapua or a Peterson and loading it straight out of the box? And I think that this is a really interesting idea and a really interesting potential. So I'm going to start working on that because I'm still, at the time I'm recording this, I still haven't gotten my old house sold and my new house purchased and moved in and settled in the workshop. But this is something I think I can work on and try and get some real results out of this. So interested to hear if any of you guys have any thoughts, if any of you guys have experimented with this in the past. I'd love to hear from you. Reach out to me on Facebook or reach out to me through email at reloadingragchew@gmail.com. Really interested to hear if someone else has already done this. If not, I think it's some data that I can really bring in. Another thing, just as a side note, I have been tooling up to start doing videos with these, so hopefully this will become a video podcast soon. I found the hardware and stuff that I was missing for the Tumble Live Ammo segment, so hopefully I'll have that one done soon, and that will probably be launched. I'm going to put this stuff on YouTube for now. I'm not going to show the reloading process, which will hopefully keep it from getting flagged. If things change and I can't stay on YouTube, if I'm getting too many videos blocked or banned, I will find another place to put it. I don't know if Full 30 is still accepting applicants or what's going on there, but I'll let you guys know and I'll get it out and I'll start putting that on all the podcasts. So I hope you enjoyed this. By the way, we are a member of the Self-Defense Radio Network, a group of podcasters talking about all different shooting sports, self-defense, and gun rights. I encourage you to check us out at SDRN webpage and check out some of the other podcasts. Thank you and have a good one.